This is a recording of the Women in Recovery meeting with Linda H. from Orange County and Linda C. from Visalia, California, taped at the First California Mid-State Regional Convention for NA in Fresno, California, on Saturday, June 30th, 1990. In observance with the 11 traditions stating anonymity at the public level, please keep this tape within the fellowship and observe the anonymity of all NA speakers.
This meeting started about 10 minutes late due to technical difficulties. Thanks for your patience. I guess at this time, I'd like to take a group conscience by show of hands that we go over 10 minutes to get the most of our speakers that we've asked this morning. Thank you. I'd like at this time to introduce our first speaker, Linda H. from Orange County.
Hi, my name is Linda, and I'm an addict.
Hi, Linda.
And I'm from Riverside County. First of all, I want to thank the committee for asking me to speak. And the way it happened, it wasn't like they heard this great tape, you know, and they said, "Whoa, we want her." They called me they called my house to ask my husband to speak because they had heard his great tape. And I said, do you guys need leaders, or I want to do the countdown, I want to do something. Well, then they called back and said, "Well, we want you to be the 20-minute speaker." I said, "Oh, okay." I said, "Well, why don't they want me to be the speaker? You know how we are." And then I had to get grateful. You know, it's like 20 minutes was a little too long for me to be somewhere when I was using it. But you're not gone yet, you know. And 20 minutes here is great, you know. I was thinking, but don't they know who I am? My story isn't it? 20 minutes won't get it, you know. And then I was going to rag about being the 20-minute speaker for 20 minutes. And I have gone through 8 or 10 different pitches that I was going to come in here and give you guys. I was in the mirror this morning and last night and on the way on the elevator. And I will be good to just get any of it out. I am so nervous. It was like for a long time I just wanted to do anything at a convention, you know. And this one's real special. This was the first convention that I ever came to. And I had 30 to 60 days, I'm not sure, and nobody was hugging me enough, you know. So I went into the marathon and I talked about it, and after that I got a whole lot of hugs and I felt real good about it. Narcotics Anonymous, I didn't know what it was. At first it was just NA, and then it was Narcotics Anonymous. And I'm like, well, do they take drugs that nobody, they don't know what it is? Or what was this Narcotics Anonymous thing, you know? And, you know, after, you know, being around for a minute, you know, I found out what it was. And, you know, I'm forever grateful to this fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous. It gave me my life back. It put God back into my life. It put so many wonderful women in my life. It put my children back in my life. It's just been too much, you know, for me. When I came to this convention the first time, I thought that I could do it again, you know, and everything was going good, and I went out one more time, you know, to find out that that the drugs were still running rampant and killing and kicking behind, you know. And I ran back into these rooms. I ran back in with my head down to here. And my feet were dirty, because I went on a run, you know. I was literally running from this place to that place trying to get that feeling that I had left before coming to Narcotics Anonymous. And because I had a couple of days clean and knew that I didn't have to feel like I felt before and I didn't have to do what I did before, and you know, that's why I had to run so hard that last run, you know. Well, go over here, they got it better over here, and then go over there, and then it wasn't any better, you know. I had a body full of drugs and a head full of recovery, and it didn't mix, you know. And I don't know, I was a typical low-down, dirty, dope fiend woman, you know, who had to do what she had to do to continue to use the drugs, you know. I lived to use and used to live, you know, at the end, and then that was it. I started off, I don't know, my mother died when I was 8. I came to California to live with my father, who I idolized. And right now I'm on some father issues, and I'm just real vulnerable about that. I thought I was going to come to California and be daddy's little girl, you know, and, you know, have all the things that I didn't have, because my mother, a single parent, we lived in the projects. You know, I hear people talking about putting cardboard in their shoes. I don't remember doing that, but somebody put it in my shoes, you know. The cardboard was there, but I didn't put it there. And I just can't got in touch with that last night. Yeah, I remember some cardboard being in my shoes. I remember not having the things that the neighbors had to eat sometimes, you know, but I had something to eat. I remember wondering why we didn't go on camping trips. You know, we didn't do all the things that the other people did. And my mother was sick all the time, and she was always in the hospital. And, you know, my complexion was different than most of the other children that I was raised around. But yet, my complexion was different, but then the hair wasn't straight enough to be over there, and you know, it was just real crazy. And then my life goal and dream was to come to California to live with my father. You know, I had all these big stories about my father in California, and they probably thought he was a movie star or something. And then when my mother died and I came to California and found out that you know, my father was just another person who had this same disease, only he chose to drink his, you know. And as soon as we got to California, he left, you know. He had to go on with his life, and he did. And I was devastated, you know, to say the least. It was like abandoned one more time, you know, by that person that was most important. And all of this didn't just manifest when I was 8 years old. I didn't know all this, but, you know, through writing and sharing and talking to other people, I realized that that's what it was. And that's why I am so anxious to get these father issues out of the way right now, because right now my father is just so in tune to his disease, and I have this love-hate relationship with him, and I want to tell him, you weren't there for me, and I want him to know that I suffered a lot from that, you know. But he's never, you know, I took him, we were going to get something to eat, and this was a very rare occasion, because my father is usually drunk. And I told him that, you know, Daddy, I don't want to drive you around when you're drunk. And I don't want you drinking, because if he's drunk, he's going to have his bottle. And I don't want you, you know, drinking in the car. And his reply was, you know, you did everything you were big enough to do in my cars. You wrecked my cars. And he said, "You pimped and you hoed in my car." I don't remember pimping. I probably did, because there was a girl with me, and she can get up off of it, and we can get something for it, go for it, you know. And he probably knew that, because he was probably the one that was giving her the money, you know. It was just real crazy. I don't know. I prayed to God to guide me through this. I didn't know I was going to get on the father issue. When you think 20 minutes, you want to get, you know, the story out. I have recovered from drug addiction. I know that I won't use drugs anymore. The 12 steps has gotten me to this point. Things are just coming up. Right now, issues with the father and the children. You know, it's like I have a 13-year-old daughter who is now it's time to let me know you weren't there for me. You don't remember when I did my first manuscript writing. You don't know when you didn't go to the PTA. When I had my fashion show, you were high. You know, all those things are coming up right now, and we hate each other, you know, and it's real painful for me, you know, right now, because I don't like her, and she doesn't like me, and that's it. She wants me to know, you know, that, you know, you look good now, but you didn't always look good, and I want you to know that, you know, yeah, she does. You know, she says it. You know, and I got to deal with it. I had a son through all my using, and that little boy. I mean, talk about unconditional love. I'm saying get away on this side, and he's over here grabbing around my leg. You know, just wanting to love me and. I hear women talk about child abuse, and I'm like, I'm glad I didn't abuse my children. But, you know, so wrong. I did. I didn't, and I thought I didn't physically do it, but, you know, I slapped him around. Leave me alone. Don't you see I'm enjoying this high, you know? And, that child, he just graduated from high school. And I was taking pictures of him, and then I screamed, "That's my boy, and I'm proud of you," you know. And then after all that, I walked away and I started to cry, you know, because, you know, I didn't think I was going to be there for him. And then he started on his little rebellious trip, and I didn't think he was going to graduate, you know, and it just all worked out so fine, and I was telling him, now that you've graduated, you have to go to college, or you have to go to the service, or you have to go somewhere, and but I meant, you know, do something with your life, get a life, you know. And, you know, I'm glad to know that he's going to college. You know, I want to go to college. And I'm just real glad, because I think that if my mother had done if I had seen some of the things that my mother had done, I would really be screwed up. And I wouldn't know if I wanted to go on, you know. And, you know, he got in some trouble. And he's gotten beyond that, and I'm just real proud of him. He was the same little boy who, when my grandmother, my addiction took me to the place where the court had taken my children from me. You know, the only thing that I could call my own, they had taken it from me. And, you know, I had to have monitored visits and, you know, I just wasn't a trusting, loving mother anymore. And, you know, I would come to my grandmother's house, and who raised me, my grandmother did. And if I was loaded or looked like I had been on a run, which I always had, you know, it was like, I don't want these kids to see you. Get out of here. And that little boy, you know, he would go to the side door and say, come in here. He would open the window, you know, and God, I don't know. There were times when she would let me come, and I would go home, and I would try to be a good little mother, and I would get up early and send them to school, and I would cook, and I would iron their little clothes. And they enjoyed it so much, and I did too. But the disease would just take back over. And after a week or so, I had to go. And all bets are off. It didn't matter. You know, I had to go. And they knew what I was going to say. Mommy, you're getting ready. Go to the store, and you won't be back. And they had my number, because that was it. I couldn't say, well, I'm an addict, and it's time for me to go practice. So I told them, look, I'm going to the store, and many times I got money from those children. Mommy, bring me this back. I didn't have any money. I didn't have anything, you know, and after they took the children from me, they told me, you know, you get into some parenting classes, and you go to a drug program, and you get a job and you get a house. I said, okay, that's simple. You know, I can do that. And it took it took me coming to Narcotics Anonymous to do any of that. You know, I tried, I got loaded and I'd go fill out an application and they wouldn't hire me. I didn't understand. Why not? You know? I bathed yesterday, you know. I combed my hair, I think. I couldn't do it. I could not do it. I couldn't get the job. I couldn't get the house. I had a real estate lady coming over to my grandmother's talking about buying a house, and I left the room and my grandmother told her, come on, she's not all there, and come on. But I was so desperate. I think when I took the drugs, all the things that I thought I needed to do came out, and I started trying to do them, but it was the wrong time, you know. The last straw was when my daughter, who's 13 now, she was 6. We had a family reunion, and in order for me to show up or face the family, I had to be loaded. It was just no doubt about it. And then, aside of being loaded, I had to look the best, I thought. And looking the best was looking promiscuous and horrid, because when I looked like that, the men told me that I looked the best. Okay, so I'm thinking, well, if I look that good to the men, I'm probably going to look good to the women, too. So, you know, and consequently, I looked awful. And they looked like, oh, boy, you know, why don't you put on something else? And, you know, during the course of a family event, I would change clothes like 3 times, you know. And it was inside, you know, change that inside and all would have been well, but I couldn't, I didn't know how. During this, the particular family reunion, I was loaded and I was going towards my daughter to hug her because I was so affectionate then. And she'd get away, you know, she pushed me back. She didn't like the way I looked, you know. Tons of makeup, probably not smelling good. Just she could tell that the other family were putting me down, and it was like, well, I don't want you either. And I found out the next day that this little girl had, you know, pushed me away, and then that was it. You know, the only 2 things I had left in my life, my son and my daughter, and then my daughter's pushing me away, you know, it's time to die, you know. And it's not time to slowly die. I wanted to die. Well, I didn't have the guts to kill myself. I didn't have the drive or the hustle up pills or whatever to overdose. I called a hotline. a suicide hotline, and after talking to this guy, he told me that he thought I probably sound like I had a drug problem rather than just being suicidal. And I said, no, I don't have a drug problem. I just use drugs for fun, you know. I don't need them, you know. And he directed me to this hospital in Downey, California, Rancho Los Amigos. And while I was there, a panel from Narcotics Anonymous came in. And it was these three guys, and it was three white guys, and one was middle-aged, and one was, he was skinny, and he was a gay guy, and the other one was an older guy, and I think 5 years and 16 months and 2 years, but when each one of them shared, I was them, you know, everything they said was me, and I couldn't understand it. You know, I said, well, obviously the counselors here have given them my profile and then told them what to say, you know, and that wasn't it. And they talked about this 12-step program and these 12 traditions, and they said these little cliches. But the most important thing they said was that they were addicts, recovering addicts, and that... And when I heard that they had been down those same paths that I had been down, you know, and they had to lay down sometimes to get the drugs, you know, and just, you know, being sick and tired of what they had, and just the whole story, it was my story. I decided then, I made a decision that I wanted what they had. I had to have what they had because I didn't have another shot. My grandmother said, if you don't make it this time, I don't know where you're going. I'm going to go ahead and legally adopt these children, and that's it. Well, I was directed to go to this program in Pasadena, and it was a long-term program, 6 to 9 months. And I had decided that I was probably going to do about 30 days and get this thing real quick and go and get the job and the house and, you know. And then I found out about the steps, and in the first 2 days I worked 1 through 12. And the tradition that said, well, I don't need that. And then I found out from going to meetings, because we went to numerous meetings a week, and then meetings came to us. And then there were women, you know, I had seen the three men, and then I kept seeing women, beautiful women that still had jewelry, you know, getting up here. Until they told my story, I just kept hearing it, I just kept hearing it. And then I heard a lady had lost her children, and she had gotten her children back. Oh, I needed her. I just felt like, oh my God, there is hope for me, you know. And that's what I found in Narcotics Anonymous. I found hope. And then I gained faith, you know, faith that I can do this thing too. And then God, there became a God in my life. And I left the program in 23 days because I got in the dreaded relationship. And me being the loyal woman that I was, they kicked him out for passing me a note. I had to go with my man, you know. And I was walking down those steps, and I looked back, and I almost went back, but, you know, I had all that pride and ego. I didn't know where I was going. I couldn't even go with the man. He was living with his mother, and he already had a woman. We were just recovery house lovers, and we hadn't even touched or anything. Anyway, I left. I left. We got together. His cry and plea was, please show me how to freebase. I said, oh my God, I'm thinking we're going to get out here and do this recovery thing together and go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And he, you know, I used again, you know, with this man. And then I began to hate him because he was those same men that were in the streets that wanted something. I needed them and they needed me. I had what they wanted, and they wanted what I had, something like that. And like I said, one more time, a head full of the program, not necessarily recovery, but a head full of the program, and a body full of drugs, and it didn't work. I started back going to the meetings again, and I was able to get a sponsor this time. I was able to start to work these steps to the best of my ability and incorporate the traditions in my life, you know. And, you know, since the first sponsor I changed, I have a sponsor today that I am able to... At one point, I was afraid to tell anybody, well, my husband said this to me. My husband made me feel like I was nothing, you know. I'm able to talk about those feelings today and talk about how I'm having this feeling or that feeling, be it good, bad, or indifferent. I'm able to share with another woman, knowing that these feelings are going to stay with this woman, and able to have other women share with me and be a friend, and not go and tell everybody in the program, well, did you know so-and-so? Because that's the kind of woman I was. You know, when I first came around here, I couldn't look you women in the face, because you women were me, you know. And I was a low-down, dirty woman that would smile at you and then go to bed with your husband, you know, and smile at you and then go take your jewelry out of your jewelry box and sell it, you know. I was no good, and today I'm some good, you know. You know, I hear these women saying they have a brand new dignity. That's how I feel. And I walk in a brand new dignity today, you know. I don't have to hold my head down for any reason and for anybody. Most of the time when I'm talking to the significant other, I got it up in the sky. So, you know, so many things have been put back in my life, you know. I got those children back into my life within a year. Since those two children, I've had two more children, and I married a guy, the guy that brought me to this convention, and I said, well, I'll go with you if you get me my own room, you know, and do it that way. Well, we had the same room, and we ended up getting married, and yeah, the 13th step sometimes works, you know. I'm just so grateful to this program. I feel like Narcotics Anonymous is my house, you know, and don't come in my house and disrespect my house, you know. This is my house, and I'm clean in this house, and when you come in my house, I want you to be clean. And my recovery has taken me to so many places. I don't have time to tell you. Recently I've gotten into this business. I haven't worked. I didn't even work when I worked, you know. And now I'm in this business, and I'm trying to do the best I can with it, and be a mother. I still want to be there for those children, because I wasn't there for so long. I was not there for those children. I have good relationships with my children. I have a little girl, and she's my heart, and you others are my heart too, in case you ever hear this tape. But the little girl, she's just something else. She just loves me, and she just rubs on me all the time, and when my hair is everywhere, Mommy, you're so pretty. And I know she's lying, but it's okay. You know, she's just an angel. And then I have this little boy, and he's special, and he's kind of shy and timid and quiet, and Mommy, I love you so much, you know. And the other two say it sometimes, but the little ones are just so needy for me, and I've always been there for them, and You know, and now I'm there for the older ones the best I can. And I'm here for the women today, you know. And that makes me feel good that I can be there for anybody, you know. I can remember a time nobody wanted me to be there. They didn't want me to be there. And, you know, today I can be there. I don't know. Is my time up? If there's anybody that's new in this program of Narcotics Anonymous works. It works slow, and it works slow, and it works slow. But it works, you know. God loves you, and I love you too.
Thank you, Linda H. And now I'd like to introduce Linda C. from Hanford.
Let me get all in order here now. I need my little stuffing stool like when I was a kid, you know. Is this right now? Okay. My name's Linda and I'm an addict. And, well, I'm totally prepared for this. I almost threw up. I cried this morning. I got real sick last night. I had to sleep through the speaker meeting. And that's how I get spiritually fit, anyway. Yeah. Anyway, I thought by the time I'd be, you know, clean for this long that I would be over all that and that, you know, I could, like, kind of pass on information to other people on how you get better and over that and get well and everything. And, you know, I get amazed. I'm sicker than I've ever been. But I don't have to use today, you know. And where's Linda that was just up here? Is she here? Oh, I really enjoyed your story. It was really neat, really neat. It was really touching. And, oh, God, here we are. I wanted to say that I'm really grateful to get to do this. And when I was asked to come here and be a speaker, I was really excited about it. I was really glad to get to do that. And I got to thinking about it, and I thought, you know, due to a whole lot of, like, self-image problems and stuff, I never went to, like, any proms or anything like that. But to me, this is kind of like getting to be the queen of the prom or, you know, like getting to be like Miss America or something, you know? Right on! Yeah! Woo! Yeah! You know? So anyway, this is like, for me, this is like a real honor. And, you know, here's what else I did to try to prepare for this. It's like, for the longest time, I wasn't being nervous or anything. And every time it would come into my mind that I was going to get up here and all that, I thought, I'd say my prayers. I'd say, God, use me as an instrument and all this stuff. And I thought, gee, I'm really doing good. And then about in the middle of last week, I thought, well, I better write down my life story just so I'll kind of like remember it. And I was doing it in shorthand, and I was going through pages and pages and pages. And then last night I went through my trip where I got real sick, and then this morning I said, I can't remember anything, and I don't know what's going to happen up here. But I do want to say that I know there's lots of rules with, you know, with the words that we're supposed to use and, like, you know, reference to other programs and stuff. So I'll just say right now that I belong to all kinds of anonymous programs because I fit into just about every kind of category. And so, and I'm standing on my tiptoes. And so every time that, so when I tell my story, you know, it's just like, to me, it's like a conglomeration of like all the stuff I've learned since I got here, you know. And, I don't know what I'm saying. But, I feel like I want to pull it down more. Kind of like there. Is that okay now? Okay. So anyway, I don't know where to begin except for kind of like at the beginning. And what I found out, see, I feel like everything I found out about myself is like I found out since I got here, you know. I mean, all I knew by the time I got here was that I was like this real screwed up person, and that I was like real nuts and sick and everything before I ever took the first one of anything, and that for the longest time, the drugs were really like a medicine for me, because I had a real hard time coping with life, and I was always on the verge of having a nervous breakdown, but what would happen instead was, like, I'd get real sick and go into a hospital and have a surgery instead, you know, and then I'd go to the therapist, and then I'd even go into the mental institutions, and I knew I wasn't quite like those people, you know. I mean, I could see that they were, like, having a real break from reality, and I wasn't having that real break from reality, but I knew, like, I wasn't, like, a functioning human being, and I didn't know what was the matter with me, you know. But anyway, what I found out since I've been here is like I've gone back over my past and kind of like looked at it and done all this stuff because like I wanted to make some sense out of it. You know, I wanted it to like have some meaning for me. And this last year's been a really meaningful year for me because for one thing, it's probably been the most painful year of my whole time. I had been living over in Morro Bay for a while. I got clean up here in Fresno and then lived between, you know, Hanford and Fresno for several years. Then I went to Morro Bay and lived over there for a while. And then, of my own free will, I moved back to Hanford. And when I moved back, I didn't know what I was in for. And it's been, like I said, one of the most painful years of my life. But I've come to believe that there's no mistakes. Like, God doesn't make any mistakes. And it's kind of like I feel like I've made a pilgrimage to, like, clean up the wreckage of my past inside my own mind. You know, because I always felt like I was faulty and defective and that I was creepy and that something was wrong and that everybody knew it. And I was trying real hard not to show that stuff. I was trying real hard to cover it up and act like a normal person. I would think stuff like, how would a normal person act, you know? Or I would, like, find somebody that I thought was really neat and I'd kind of, like, copy their mannerisms, their handwriting, the way that they dress, their style of vocabulary. I was always trying to look for something to be, you know? And so anyway, when I came back to Hanford this time, it's been really good because I've been able to have some really long talks with my mother and to kind of start making some sense out of, like, how I ended up to be who I am today. And what I found out in this last year was that, you know, oh, I even went into therapy, too, because it's like the pain got so bad. And What kind of brought it all on was I didn't have my daughter living with me for a really, really long time, for about five years. Yeah, that's one of the reasons I went over to Morro Bay. She was living over there with her dad, and the courts wouldn't give her back to me. And I'd been wanting her in my life for a really long time. So I decided, well, if she can't come to me, then I'll go over there and be with her and at least get to see her a little bit more frequently. And so anyway, after 3 years of being over there and having more of a shared custody, her dad decided to let her come back and live with me. So this last year, I went through some major changes. I had a career change, you know. I started being a drug counselor, which, like, blows my mind. I had my daughter with me, you know, and I hadn't had her for a long time, and she's 12 years old. And I moved back and started, like, having conversations with my mother. And what started happening, see, was like a whole lot of like painful stuff started surfacing, and I thought I was losing my mind at first, okay? And I remember that I hadn't smoked for probably 5 years, and I started picking up cigarettes to smoke them because I just knew I had to have something. I mean, I felt like I was going nuts. I felt like my skin was coming off, and I didn't know who I was on the inside. And a girlfriend came over one night because she thought I sounded suicidal. And she was saying, what is it? What is it, you know? And I was trying to explain to her where I was at, and it was like right in the process of trying to explain to her, it was like I stopped because what I could see was I could see my own fear, you know? It was like I looked into the eyes of my own fear, and I saw that I'd been this very frightened person all my life, and that, if you want to call it, that is my defect of character. Is that I am so afraid, and it shows itself in all kinds of ways. I'm afraid that I'm not a good enough person, I'm not a good enough mother, I'm gonna die, the list went on and on. But at that one moment when I saw the fear, it was like it didn't even have any other name other than just fear, and I just looked at it, and it took my breath away. And I understood in that moment, I understood why the drugs were such a good friend to me for so long. I am such a frightened person. And I had to use the point where it was proven to me that I couldn't use anymore because I'm so scared of life, you know? I'm chicken shit, you know, all the way through and through. And I've been trying all my life to cover it up. But anyway, so through the process of, like, it getting real bad, I made some decisions to try to, like, work through it. And I got a therapist, and he's a 12-step person, and so we talk about the steps and bring that into the therapy, and it's real helpful. I feel like I'm getting, like, a deep cleaning, you know, like cleaning out those pimples that are way down in there. And kind of a spiritual facial or something, I don't know. So anyway, what started happening was, like, for a long time I was, like, really mad at my mom. It's like, you fucker, man, my life's been shit. How dare you have done this to me? You know, like, I deserve so much better. And I was really, really mad, you know. And I couldn't even talk about issues to her because I was, like, I was so afraid I was going to get mad, so I just wouldn't say anything. And then through the process of going through the therapy, I started realizing that I can just, like, talk about the stuff. Like, I don't have to attack. I don't have to get mad. I don't have to do any of that stuff. I could just talk to her as, like, one woman to another. And it's been the most enlightening thing because I started to see, like, who my mother was when I was this little baby, see. And who she was, she wasn't married when she was pregnant with me. And in her time, she was, like, real ashamed of that. She was, like, real ashamed of that. She was so ashamed of that she didn't even go, like, to a doctor, okay, until she was, like, 8 or 9 months pregnant. And then when she did go to a doctor, she went to an off-the-wall doctor in this off-the-wall hospital, you know, so, like, that it wouldn't be seen or noticed. And I think that was, like, my introduction to the world, you know. It was, like, I kind of, like, didn't feel, like, super well. I think I had gotten mixed messages. I think, you know, she probably loved me, but she also, like, was ashamed of me, you know. And so what I did was I lived my life, I took that on, you know, I carried that. And when I was a little kid, see, I knew when I was a little kid, I was always this, like, real good little kid. You know, like, I didn't do wrong, bad stuff like kids are supposed to do. And I knew there was something wrong with that, you know. And what I came to find out was, like, I was trying so hard to be, like, so good, to, like, not be a pain in the ass or anything so that I'd be wanted, you know. And what ended up happening in my early life was my parents, they did get married, and then they got divorced. And my mom, she decided that she didn't want me to dress poor like she had to be when she was a kid, so she decided to work 2 jobs, you know. And what that did was it left me, you know, without, like, a mother, you know. So what I did was I hung around with my grandmother, you know. My grandmother became, like, my main person in life. And I remember, because I remember when I went back to do my inventory, I was trying to picture my mom. I wanted to see what my issues were with her, you know. And I was trying to remember her, and all I could see was this picture of my mom's back, you know, darting back and forth in the kitchen fast, you know. And I tried to remember, did I ever have eye contact with her? I didn't remember her talking to me. I didn't remember her having eye contact, you know. I just remember her being busy, and I remember my grandmother talked to me a lot. And which was all real nice and everything, except for by the time I was, like, 6 years old, my mom married this man, and we went to Guam, okay? And, you know, like, I wasn't prepared, like, that we were going to make this big move, and I wasn't prepared to leave my grandmother that had been the one that was the main person in my life. And I just kind of, like, got swept away and put in, you know, thousands of miles away with this man that was real scary to me because he was an Italian and he was loud, and I was used to, like, real quiet living. And here I was with my mother that I didn't really even know, you know, because she'd been so busy. And it was kind of like, I think it would be like if being placed in a foster home, you know. So here I am with these people and starting a new life, age 6. And I think what happened at that point was, like, I started making a whole lot of opinions about who I was and what the world was all about. Born to be a self-destructive person, I always made the decisions that made me feel the creepiest, you know, like that I am, you know, like I'm not worth it and I'm not good enough and, you know, no matter what I do, it's never good enough and all that. And what happened was this man that my mom married was a Catholic, okay, and I hadn't gone to any kind of church before, and I started going to Catholic church, and this was like, it filled this void in my life, okay? I felt so in love with God, with the church, with all this stuff. And I had this new awareness that just came to me about 2 weeks ago. I went to a retreat at a Catholic place. The priest was leading the retreat. And I started remembering back to when I was this little girl that was this Catholic, okay? I remember having a spiritual awakening as a little girl. I remember standing in the church, and I could feel the breeze flowing through me. And I remember, like, tears welling up in my eyes, and it just, you know, like, ran down because I was, like, so full of the love of God. You know, even just to talk about it now, I can still remember it. It was a really powerful experience in my life. It was probably one of the most positive, powerful experiences in my life. And what happened was I started, like, devoting my life to God as a little girl, you know. I was devoting my life to God. I had Catholic statues, okay, Blessed Virgin Mary statue in my room. I would go out and I would get little flowers and I would put them in at the little altar and I'd sing little songs, you know, and I was doing all that. And what I remembered at this retreat a couple of weeks ago was what I wanted to be when I grew up was I wanted to be a saint, you know. I don't want to be a nurse or doctor. I wanted to be a saint. And you know, in the little kid's mind, I really thought I was going to be one, you know? And what happened was I was waiting until I knew as I got older, my sainthood would begin to blossom and dawn, and I would be able to know that I was going to be a saint because I'd be able to perform miracles, okay? I was going to be able to perform miracles. And probably on, like, Good Friday, my hands would start bleeding and my feet would start bleeding. And so I'd look for it, you know, and it's like, and it wasn't happening, and I couldn't understand, because that's what I wanted to be, man. And, you know, it was really, I was in awe when I had that memory a couple of weeks ago, because I thought, you know, as a little kid, I didn't know any better, and I was so disappointed to grow up and just be human, you know. I mean, like, wow, I thought I had to be just a little bit above everybody else, you know, like, I had to be a little bit more virtuous. I had to be a little bit more kind. I had to think of your feelings more than mine. You know, I was like real codependent. And anyway, what happened then was I had this God in my life, which filled, you know, the void that wasn't there for my family. And it was all real good. Until my mother had a baby. She started a second family. And I had, you know, sibling rivalry stuff, and that was, like, real hard for somebody that's going to be a saint to have those kinds of feelings, you know? Like, I wasn't supposed to have, like, resentment, anger, jealousy, hatred, and all that, and I've always had a real hard time with that stuff in my life. It's like I want to cut it off and put it over here, you know? Like, I don't want that stuff. Like, I don't, it's not me, you know? I'm virtuous. So anyway, I remember doing some stuff like to take out my anger on this kid, okay? Like, he got a Christmas present, was a drum, and I jumped on it and broke it, and I let him take the blame for breaking it. And, you know, so that got to haunt me through the whole rest of my life. You know? But anyway, what happened then was, like, when he was 2 years old, he got real, real sick. He got leukemia, and he died. And nobody, you know, explained to me what was going on with him. But what I kind of got out of, like, what was happening was, like, maybe it was, like, because my feelings towards him, maybe, like, I was somehow a little bit responsible because, like, I wasn't real loving and kind and caring and concerned because I was jealous of him. Yeah. I was supposed to be his babysitter, and I didn't want to be the babysitter. And so I was in a real lot of conflict because I was carrying around that kind of feelings, and I couldn't tell anybody, you know. And then what happened was when he died, I remember hearing the people, the grown-ups around me saying, oh, because my mother was like 9 months pregnant or 8 months pregnant. She had a baby the next month after he died. And I remember hearing them say, what kind of a God is this that would take the baby that we already know and give us one that we don't know? And I remember I thought, yeah, what kind of a God is that? And I started like turning against God, which was the one thing in my life which I had, you know. So I started turning against God, and I remember I said something along the lines of, like, that I hated God or something. And my cousin says, oh, you're going to get it. And she says, you know, like, that God was going to come and get me. And I said, I'll close my eyes. I'll get under the bed and close my eyes. And she says, you can't close your eyes from God. He'll shine through them. I was like, oh, wow. Nowhere to hide. I'm busted, you know. I was like, now I'm evil bad, you know. And so I was like really, you know, from that point on, what I remember as being a kid is I was like really mixed up. I had like a whole lot of mixed up feelings. I wasn't like the kind of, there was two more children born, you know. And I was like the babysitter and stuff, and it really was awful for me because I felt like I was supposed to be controlling these kids, and I had no idea in the world like how to control kids. So all I would do is like I'd be angry at them. I was always angry at them because they wouldn't do what I'd say, and it would make me look bad to my parents. You know, they'd be climbing out of their strollers, and I'm supposed to be pushing them around, and they'd say, well, push them up, I did it. And so it was like a no-win situation, and I think for years and years and years I carried around guilt that my brother and sister were going to grow up and they were going to know how I felt about them as kids, you know, and they were going to like hate me for it. But I didn't have compassion for the kid I was. I didn't have understanding for the kid I was. I just looked at that stuff and I said, oh, that's bad. You're a bad person. You're a bad person to have that. We moved back from Guam and moved all over the United States for a real long time until like sixth grade. We moved to Hanford and that's where we, you know, kind of settled down. And it was at that point in my life where I started having some friends in my life. And started having like a little gang that I'd hang around with. And I started going through like a personality change. Because up until then, I'd been like a real passive, like good little kid and everything. Now I'm starting to be more like semi-delinquent, you know, like mouthing off. Still going to Catholic school, I'm mouthing off to the nuns, and they'd call up my mom. And I think I tripped the nun one time, you know, just to be smart aleck or something. And anyway, I started going through those kinds of changes. And I started going through the changes of... you know, the adolescent stuff that we all go through, and it was like real trippy for me. And I did not have a very good image about myself, so when I got up to the age of where you start dating and stuff like that, I didn't see myself as desirable young lady, and I didn't see guys as anything other than like they were real scary to me. You know, I didn't have like real good relationship with my stepdad or any of the men in my life, and I just felt like that these men, that they knew the goods about me, and what it was like I was a creep and they knew it. So the pain of that stuff was like so great that what I did was I got real fat all of a sudden. I guess I must have indulged in some kind of a eating disorder, but I don't remember eating. All I know is like all of a sudden I got fat, and I didn't know what to do about it, so I went to the doctor and I got some diet pills, okay? And I liked them, you know. And I didn't care if I didn't have to go out on a date. I mean, it took that away from me. I was like, thank you. I don't want to have to deal with another human being. I don't want to have to deal with trying to be intimate. I don't want to have to try to deal with getting to know someone else. And I had this seed, see, and that made me feel good. It made me feel real good. It made me feel so good that I didn't like when I was coming down. So what I'd do is I'd start splitting up my pills. I'd take half one in the morning and half one in the afternoon so I could, like, prolong my high, you know, so I didn't have to come down. And I just kind of, like, went off into drug land about at that point, you know. And I didn't do it, like, all in one day. And I didn't see myself as an addict. But what ended up happening was, from the time I was 16 years old till the time I was 21, I went through high school, went through college, I was getting real sick. I had a lot of sickness in my life, and I was reading books on yoga and meditation, and I was eating healthy foods. I had my own little juicer, and I was doing all this good stuff in my life. I was going to, like, heal myself. And what ended up happening was it's like it wasn't happening fast enough. I wasn't getting enough results, and I didn't like feel like I had the I didn't want to wait all the rest of my life to get good. And I was like at a crossroads in my life where I could like keep on doing it that way or go the way of the drug way, and that was the way that I chose to go. Well, I don't even know if I had a choice in it, to tell you the truth. I mean, that's the way I went. That's where I ended up going. And so by the time I was 21 years old, I was shooting heroin daily, drinking Mai Tais in the bar and, you know, living on welfare and living with a guy that was a heroin addict. And, you know, we would do stuff like sell the heater to get a fix, you know, and then have to turn the oven on to keep warm. We were just, you know, like little kids, really. We were like little kids that were, you know, in this world, and we were just like on this adventure, and it took us to crazy places. And what ended up happening was he went to jail, and I didn't think I could survive as a drug addict on my own, because I'd always look to him to, you know, keep it going. And what I found out was, like, that I could, you know, like, I was really resourceful, you know, I never knew I was. I always saw myself as this helpless little, hopeless thing, and what I found out was, hey, you know what, I got a lot of talents, and I could, you know, I put them to good use. But anyway, and I could, like, double talk to these doctors better than anybody I knew. I mean, this to me is, like, typical of, like, how it worked. Was I had this one doctor that was writing me prescriptions for Dilaudid, and I'd call him up to get the prescription, and he was like, no, he wasn't going to give it to me, and he told me I was strung out. He knew that I was such a pain in the ass that he would say stuff to me, like he'd say, okay, I'm going to write you the prescription. I'm putting it out by my back door underneath the mat. Don't come through the office. I'd say, oh, thank you. Or the other doctor that I did a number on, too, that I thought was pretty good, was it was a diet pill doctor. And I went to him, and I said, because I was skinny at the time. I was probably, like, under 100 pounds. And I went to him, and I didn't know how I was going to get it from him, but I said, well, you know, it's the strangest thing. When I take diet pills, I eat more. He said, oh, okay. And he wrote me, you know, gave me some. And then I come back to him again, and I say, you know what? It's really weird. If I take a couple of them a day, I even eat more. And he was like, all right. And that went on for a while until I lost weight, and the nurse told him, and then he cut me off. But, when I look back at that stuff, I think, I just can't believe, you know, like, the crap I could come up with, and it worked, you know. But, anyway, my life started to change in that I had to have a surgery, emergency surgery. And they put me in the hospital, and they detoxed me and all this. And it was at that point I decided, well, I'm going to go home to Mom's house, and then I will live a straight life, because I've been doing heroin for a couple years, and I knew, like, I needed to get away from it, or I'd probably end up doing it to the day I died. So I went back to Mom's house and didn't know what to do with myself. I remember waking up, and I'd be in my little room, and I'd kind of be okay in my little room, but I didn't know how to act when I went outside the door of that room. And when I look back over it now, what I realize is I've gone through a psychic change. I went through a psychic change from my drug use, okay? I was not a person that I knew anymore. I couldn't relate to who I was anymore. And I didn't know how to be anymore. And the best that I knew how to do was I called up the mental health services, and they invited me to come down and be part of their day treatment, which I did for a whole year. And it was like one more time I was around these people that were nuts, but I knew I was a little bit different, but I still wasn't like good enough to be in with the working people, the mainstreamers. And so I did that. And they put me on psychiatric medicine, and I took it because they said that I was about ready to start hallucinating, and I didn't know if they were right or wrong, you know. And I'd taken the personality test, but I'd taken a little bit of acid when I took it, so I didn't know if that influenced their decision or not, you know. But I thought, oh, well, they might be right. I better do it. And then they'd give me pills to counteract the side effects, you know. And everybody was saying, oh, Linda, you're doing so good, because I wasn't sticking needles in my arms. And I thought, yeah, you know, yeah, I'm doing good, And I just was like, you know, fairly functional. And a lot of you probably know what that's like if you don't have a program of recovery, you know, and to try to, you know, do anything. So what happened was then I started doing the the whole lot of the prescription drug, you know, calling this doctor, calling that pharmacy, this doctor, that pharmacy, da, 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 and just keeping the whole thing going. And, you know, it's like my whole thinking was centered in drugs in one way or the other, and getting and using and finding ways to get more. And I would buddy up with people that worked in pharmacies and get them that way, you know. And I got married to this man that was wealthy, and money was no problem, and he didn't care that I used. He used to, but he didn't use as much as me, but he never nagged at me, and I could, like, filter out of the checking account incredible amounts of money, which I did. And I would do stuff like pay the lady that worked in the pharmacy more for the drugs so she'd give them to me instead of selling them out there to anybody else. And, you know, I guess what I found out is that I could be pretty clever, crafty, or, you know, I could come up with whatever I needed to come up with to make it keep going. But what ended up happening was, is like I continued to get more and more ill. I had this disease in my intestines that would, like, really make me sick. And I was, like, really, you know, having to go to the hospital a lot to get blood transfusions and stuff like that. And I ended up getting pregnant. And the doctors told me, they says, you need to have an abortion because you're just too sick. And they had me on cortisone. And in my peewee little brain, I thought, I didn't think I'd ever be able to have a baby. Well, I couldn't not have this baby, you know. I mean, I couldn't have an abortion. I had to have this baby because I might not ever have one. Just like when my husband asked me to marry him, I said, yes, because I didn't think anybody else would ask, and I better take it, you know. You take it while you can get it. And so anyway, that's what I did, and I continued to use throughout that pregnancy, and that baby ended up dying full-term, stillborn baby. And, you know, when that baby died, I think a big piece of me died. It was at that point I think I knew that I was an addict. You know, I think up until then I thought I had control over it. But I couldn't understand why I couldn't control myself. I got into a deep, deep, deep depression that I did not come out of until after I had several years clean. I finally started coming out of that depression. I kind of like lost the desire to have fun. I mean, nothing was exciting anymore. I was just making it through one day at a time. And I was using all kinds of prescription drugs that I could get my hands on to medicate my feelings, and I was just putting in my time. I started praying to God. I wanted to have a baby, and I promised God that I would be good, you know. And through the grace of God, I got pregnant, and I did. I was, like, good during that time. But being the conniving addict that I was still getting my prescriptions filled, but I was stockpiling them, you know, stockpiling. I got myself a little safe that had a lock on it, you know. Really not. But anyway, and I started doing some stuff that I do in my life today at that point. It was the first time I tried to make contact with God in years, you know, in years and years. But I started, like, praying to God on a daily basis every night before I went to bed. When I'd find myself, like, thinking all kinds of crazy, nutty thoughts, I'd stop myself and I'd kind of start putting in some positive thoughts, you know. Like, I knew enough to do that kind of stuff way back then. And I made it through that pregnancy. And I had my daughter, and she was, you know, she weighed like 8 pounds, 3 ounces, and they said, you know, she was like real big. And when I was 9 months pregnant, I weighed as much as I weigh today. That, you know, I was like little, you know. And so anyway, they were all saying that she was like a miracle baby and this and that. And I was so grateful to God to have her, you know. And what ended up happening was, like, I knew that I couldn't nurse her because I had to get back to my drugs. I'd waited long enough, you know. And I regretted it. I knew that I could be bonded with her better and everything, but I knew that I could not wait another day. That was it, you know. And I did as much as I could do to just do it that good. And so anyway, you know, I had the what seemed like a perfect little, you know, middle-class life. We had a brand new home. My husband had his own business. I had my little girl. I had, you know, shopping. I could go shopping anywhere I wanted. I bought all kinds of everything. I had a real shopping addiction. And nobody ever got on me about it. And I would hide things, you know. And I was having fun. Life was, you know, all right there for a while. And what happened, though, was, like, I kept using and kept using. And I started drinking, like, out-of-control drinking, around-the-clock drinking. And when she was, like, about 3 years old, I had to have part of my stomach cut out because I kept thinking I had the flu, you know. It's like every 2 days I'd get the flu. And what it was like my stomach, like the stuff wasn't being able to go through, but I could hold like enough booze and pills for like 2 days before I'd start throwing it up. And after doing that for about 6 months, it dawned on me that people don't have the flu that much for that long. So I went to the doctor and they had to take out part of my stomach. And the doctors told me then, they said, you know, you were loaded with booze and drugs and you're an addict and you're an alcoholic. And what I did with that information was, well, first of all, like, I got really, really scared. And I said to them, could they, when I was having that surgery, I was, like, real sick. And I said, could they send in a psychiatrist to talk to me because I was really, really scared. And there was a nurse there. And she was bringing me, like, religious stuff to read, like, out of the Bible stuff. And I was kind of, like, hanging on to it because here was a person that was paying attention to me, and I was so very afraid, excuse me, that I was, like, wanting to hear what she had to say just so that she'd be there for me. But in the back of my mind, what I was thinking is I thought, oh, lady, you don't know, you know, like, that God stuff's real nice. Yeah, that's real nice and that's real neat, but man, I need like some real help. And I thought maybe you know, the best surgeon in the world or the world's top psychiatrist or something, but you know, that God stuff was just too far remote for me. And anyway, I made it through that one. I was still, you know, a crazy, insane, raging addict. I had a tube down my throat to have all the stuff sucked out, and when they took that out, I had my husband smuggle into the hospital for me some cocaine so that I could, you know, do it. And here I just come through a surgery that they wouldn't even do the surgery on me for a week till they built me up because I was so run down. And that was like the kind of abuse I put myself through, you know, and that was just the routine for me, and I didn't know any different. And when they would tell me to quit, I thought what they were saying is cut down, you know, that's all I could ever hear. I didn't hear the word quit. And then, you know, things got worse, as they have a way of doing. And I went into a treatment center. I was, you know, coerced by my husband and my mother and my sister and my dad, and I said, okay, I'll go. And I went into the ARC up in Fresno, and I was weighing probably 75 pounds. My hair was falling out because my liver was failing, and, you know, I had some cavities in my front teeth, and I was just this, like, wimpy, probably looked like 20 years older than I do today. And I went in there, and I went into the detox. And I remember I would pull the cover over my head. And I thought that was so different because I would never do that before because I always thought I was going to smother or something. But this time it seemed more right, you know. Like I just knew like I was more different than I'd ever known me before. And they were giving me some, I think, Dilantin or something to prevent seizures. And they were giving me some Tylenol, like, every 4 hours. Well, you know, one of my main problems is, like, I think I know better than anybody else, always and forever. I know better than any doctor, any psychiatrist. I mean, I'll let them advise me a little bit, but I'm always the one that makes the main decisions on what's best for me, you know. And so I knew that was nice that they were giving me Tylenol every 4 hours, but I had to supplement it with some aspirin. And what I didn't know was that my liver was so bad that the aspirin made me hemorrhage and my liver couldn't make my blood clot and I started bleeding to death, okay? They come and they take me out of the treatment center and they put me in the intensive care unit. On the way up there, the doctor says, did you take some aspirin? I said, uh-uh. No way. Now my life's hanging there, you know, like I'm gonna maybe die, and I'm afraid of him being mad at me for taking aspirin, so I say, no, I didn't take anything, you know, no way. And that's the kind of value I put on my life, you know, like I didn't even know any better than to think I was worth, you know, telling the truth about. So, anyway, when I was up there in the intensive care unit, what ended up happening was they had an IV in each one of my wrists. And the bleeding wouldn't stop, and the bleeding wouldn't stop. And they were going to do a surgery on me. And I remember that I was so tired. I'd never been so tired in all my life. Throughout all my using, I'd never been that tired. And I was so tired I couldn't even pull myself up on the bedpan. And then it was like, they were going to do a surgery like on Monday or something. And this was like on a Friday. And the priest came in and he said prayers with me, and my brother was there, and my mother came to see me, and my mother and my husband were in the room, and I remember telling them that I could see the, I said, where's that yellow light coming from? And they didn't see the yellow light, okay? I could see the yellow light because I think I was about ready to go over to the other side. And while I was laying there in that, on that bed, what I came to realize was, I came to realize that all the time I ever thought I was getting away with something, you know, like sneaking around getting drugs or stealing them from whoever or, you know, calling this doctor and that, that I wasn't never really getting over on anybody because the only one that I was up against was me, you know. It was like, it came down to two. It was like me and God, and there was no cheating left to do. There was nowhere left to run, you know, like, even if I died, I had this belief that we'd probably come back, and I thought, even if I die, I'm still going to have to face up, you know, like there's no escape anymore. And it was at that point that I made an attempt to pray to a God that I hadn't prayed to since I was a little girl over on Guam. And my prayers were real simple. I said, you know, God, if they do the surgery on me, I think I'm going to die, so if you want me to live, I'll be yours, but you don't let them do that because I'm too tired. I'm too tired. Well, what ended up happening was by the time Monday came around, the bleeding had finally started to stop, and I started on the road to recovery, okay? And after being in intensive care for a while, I came back downstairs, and I walked into my first NA meeting. We weren't required to go to any of the NA meetings. They took us to AA meetings at this treatment place. But I wanted to go down to the NA meeting and give it a try. And I went down there, and it was the first meeting I'd been to where they had, like, candlelight, and that was, like, real refreshing for me because I'd been in that, what, fluorescent lights or whatever they call that, and it had, so that was real great because I didn't have to feel like I was staring at people or they were staring at me. And the lady that ended up to be my sponsor, she was celebrating 5 years at that point. And I remember her telling her story, and I thought, well, here's a woman that she really has been where she said she's been. I could tell by the way she told her story. And what I kind of heard a lot of wasn't even so much what she said, but I was watching her, and I thought, God, she's so alive, you know? And she had worked that day, and she still had all this energy, and it had been years since I'd had energy. You know, I couldn't even clean the house anymore. I was so beaten down. And I thought, I wonder if I could ever be like that. I wonder if that could ever happen to me in my wildest dreams, you know. And I remember she had bought a blouse to celebrate her birthday, and I thought, wow, it was just so attractive. So I kept going back to the meetings, and I was so afraid of dying that I became willing to go to any length, and I became willing to take direction, and I became willing to do it somebody else's way other than my way. That was my big stumbling block, was I really didn't think anybody else knew anything, you know. So I became willing to try a different way, and I went and I lived in a recovery home for a year. And when I was in that recovery home, I had all kinds of little spiritual awakenings along the way. I remember one of the first ones was I was in the bathroom and I was looking around, and I thought, well, am I dead or am I alive? Where am I anyway, you know? Because I didn't know if maybe I'd really died in that hospital bed and I went somewhere else and this was the next life over. And I thought, well, I'm not walking through walls, so I must still be on Earth. Oh, okay, must be still on Earth. But then I'm looking around and I'm going, okay, now here's some walls and a sink. And I thought, well, I didn't create that stuff, you know? And then I look over at me and I go, and I didn't create me either, you know?
I think up until then I thought that I was somehow responsible for my life on earth, you know. And I was punishing myself endlessly over it. And I thought, oh, well, if I didn't make me, then there's probably a power greater than myself that made me, and then I'm, you know, I don't have to sweat it anymore. Just, like, live. And that was a good one for me, because I didn't understand that there was really something else more than just me. And I remember being really, really afraid, and I remember having the words go through my mind that there was probably no human power that was ever going to be able to fix me, you know, and that the only chance I ever had on ever getting any better was going to be through a power greater than myself. And what that did was it gave me courage to go to places I've never gone before within my own mind, within my own life. And I still use that to get me through when I'm going through, like lately going through like a lot of emotional shit, going through dredging up a lot of the past, the codependency stuff, the dysfunctional family stuff. I got really, really afraid when I started experiencing a lot of those feelings, when I started having a lot of pain in my life. And what I had to remember was that God got me through those early days, you know, and that, like, God either is real or God isn't real, and you can't have it both ways. See, I always forget that. It's like, on a really good day, I bet I'll trust God, like, maybe 10%, you know? And that's just who I am, you know? And so what I have to start doing is I have to really start turning it over. When I had that realization not too long ago that what my big problem in life was that I was, like, so full of fear, I started treating my fear as if it was my defect of character, and I started working the sixth step and the seventh step on it. Instead of like going in the roundabout ways, I started like asking God on the point of fear to like remove my fear and direct my attention to what He'd have me be, you know. And I just keep trying to do that over and over again because I'm such a fearful person. I was afraid to stand up in front of you guys. I'm afraid to like, you know, talk to my friends because they're going to know like that I'm really inadequate. You know, before I came to this meeting, since they asked me to be the speaker, I had probably about 5 dreams that I used. You know, I kept having these dreams that I used, and then I couldn't get up here and tell you guys, you know, what it was like. And I kept wondering, what was that all about? I thought, gee, I feel so guilty all the time. And what it came down to for me was I realized that I feel so inadequate, you know, like I'm afraid like you guys are going to see through me and know that I'm really nothing on the inside. And I remember when I was a kid, I used to have dreams, right? I used to have dreams that I'd go to school and I'd look down and I didn't have my clothes on, you know? So I thought like I was going to get up here and I'm going to look down and I don't have my clothes on. To me, that's what a lot of what the program's like though, you know? It's like it gives me the opportunity to let you know who I really am. And that is so freeing. I have really, truly been being set free in this program. I've been being set free from my old beliefs. When I started going back and discovering that how my mom, the circumstances of my birth, I started to understand that I don't have to carry that one. I've been carrying that for all my life, and I don't have to. You know, it wasn't my shame. It wasn't my shame, and I can let her have that. So today when I start wanting to react out of shame or react out of guilt, I question myself. I say, did you do anything really wrong? And if the answer is no, then I realize that I'm starting to do it again, and I let it go. See, I've been such a people pleaser, such a codependent. I think, you know, I was such a codependent before I ever took anything that I'm always trying to make you feel good on what I think that you're thinking, you know, so that you, like, won't be mad at me, you know. And if you just say, like, have a different opinion than me, I think you've put me down, you know, like, oh, you don't like me because you like red instead of blue, you know. It's really weird. I remember another one of my little spiritual awakenings in this program was I went to go buy a pair of shoes. And the state rehab was going to pay for them. And what it came down to was I could buy the white ones or the gray ones. I really wanted the white ones, but it was more practical to buy the gray ones. So I was suffering over this, and I was going through major dilemmas, and I would say, God, please help me. And then I got real serious about, like, God, please help me. Like, for real. Okay. And
And I went back to the store probably 3 days in a row. I got so sick I almost threw up. It was that bad. Okay. What I came up with is, like, God helped me. What God told me in a roundabout way was, hey, you got free will. You got freedom of choice. Have fun with it. Why do you always have to be, you know, make it such a serious thing? Buy the gray ones this year, buy the white ones next year, and you can buy blue ones too. And I went, oh, all right. You know, I didn't know. I didn't know. Because it was never fun to me to make a decision. I always knew it was going to be the wrong one. And so, you know, these are the areas that I've been being freed up in. I get my dreams and my realities all mixed up because it's like all the stuff's going on. I'll have dreams like where I'll tell people what I really think and what I really feel. And I'm like starting to do that in my life. I even started telling God what I really think or what I really feel. For the longest time, I was saying my prayers like how I thought I was supposed to. Like, I knew I wasn't supposed to ask for anything, but I kind of, like, in a roundabout way, asked for something. I don't know if you guys can relate to that one. And then I finally started saying, and I read this book, and it says, don't lie to God. And I said, oh, okay. Okay, God, you know what I really, really want, but what I'll do is I'll do whatever you really want. But it was okay to start admitting, yeah, I have wants. Mm-hmm. I have desires. I'm a human being. You know, I didn't know that stuff before. I tried to be this little saint that never quite blossomed, you know, that was full of, like, resentment, anger, and fear. And it's been very uncomfortable existence inside my skin here. But through the program, through the sharing, and through the loving that I've got, I feel 100% whole today compared to anything I've ever been in my entire life. And I really believe that it will not stop here. I believe that it only gets better and better. That's been my experience. I thought for a long time that if I had time in the program, I wasn't supposed to hurt anymore. I thought that I was doing something wrong. Maybe I wasn't doing the steps quite right. That isn't the truth. You know, if you come here and somebody makes you think that you're going to get clean and that you're not going to hurt anymore, they're really lying to you. You know, but what I'll tell you is that you will hurt, and you'll probably hurt worse than you ever hurt in your whole entire life, but you don't have to use, and when you come through it with God on your side, you will grow into a person that you couldn't have ever grown into if you didn't go through the pain. That's been my experience. And I'm so grateful to have been asked to come here, and I probably went way over time, I don't know. And thanks.